shore.
Yes, it did. It came right across, right down over top of us, right there.
There is the Hurricane Landfall Project truck. It's all set up, strapped down. We're going to turn all the switches on in just a little while. Standing outside of the Chevy Tahoe, we are getting into the eye wall of Hurricane Gene right now. Four came in on shore here along the southeast coast of Florida.
These little bullet cams right here that we will use to record that surge.
It's about 9 o'clock now, central time, which means that if we set them up and turn them on right now, they'd run until about noon tomorrow.
Does thunderstorm activity appear to consolidate around that eye?
That is storm surge from the Atlantic Ocean, the overwash coming in.
You're listening to Stories from the Hurricane Highway, the weekly podcast series that takes an in-depth look back at over two decades of tracking hurricanes, technology, behind-the-scenes stories, and much more. I'm your host, Mark Suddeth. So glad you could join me, and thank you for supporting this exclusive podcast via Patreon. Hello again, and welcome to another edition of Stories from the Hurricane Highway. I am so glad you could tune in once again, especially these next two episodes, because we're going to talk about failure and disappointment. And I know you might literally be thinking, wow, that's uplifting. Great. Great way to start the episode, Mark, but I'm serious. These next two episodes, which will cover August 30th and August 31st, 2005, are extremely important in the evolution of this whole project and, you know, where we are today in 2021 when I'm putting this podcast episode together. Everything is connected, and these two episodes are very, very important in that process. And so, you know, without breaking precedence of what we've been doing throughout this Katrina saga, each episode has been basically covering a specific day. That's what I will continue to do. So this episode will be all about August 30th, 2005, the first full day in the aftermath period of Hurricane Katrina. You know, it made landfall on the 29th. We know that. Brought a devastating, just unbelievable storm surge to Mississippi, also a massive surge to Louisiana. But Louisiana had other problems now related to that surge. You know, you had the surge that came from the Gulf, but you also had the storm surge from Lake Pontchartrain, as we now know, that worked its way in and eventually defeating the hurricane protection system in New Orleans, Lower Ninth Ward, Metairie. And we were starting to learn about that in great detail on the 30th, but I was not in New Orleans. We know that. My story, and my story is plural, and those of my colleagues, are in Mississippi. And so that's what we're going to do. We're going to pick up on Tuesday now, August 30th, 2005, as we continue with Stories from the Hurricane Highway. All right, so picking up where we left off, I left Gulfport with Mike Watkins late in the afternoon on the 29th, a devastated Gulfport. We got through and around Mobile. That was a chore in and of itself. Made it as far east as Tallahassee, got a hotel, crashed and slept, you know, probably broken sleep for a few hours anyway. Very hard to get sleep after something like one of these happens. And a lot of shock going on of the things we saw and people that we know that are, you know, harmed. And it's hard. It's hard to process. It really is. So we got some sleep. And then the goal here on the 30th is kind of twofold. First task, I got to get Mike back to his car in Lake City. Remember, it's parked at the Memorial Hospital there in Lake City. They gave us permission to put it in their parking lot before we left on this whole event several days earlier. And I had to get him back, and he was going to go back on down to Coconut Creek, Fort Lauderdale area, and resume his life. And you can only imagine how that must have been, you know, going back and just kind of turning it all off, if you will, and working in an office setting. He worked for Office Depot doing analytics and model building, you know, helping them with their mailing catalog system and so forth. and it's in an office setting. It's kind of quiet. You know, he's in a cubicle probably. Maybe he had an office. I don't remember. But that had to be difficult, you know, I'm sure. And so he had to go do that and kind of just resume life beyond Katrina and just bring it all to a halt. And I had to make a decision after dropping him off. Do I go ahead and go back to North Carolina, go back home with my family, and come back to Mississippi days, weeks, months later and try to find the boxes? Or do I go back immediately? Because time, I felt, was really of the essence in having any chance of locating any of those three missing storm case units. You know, inside of each case, a VCR that presumably recorded everything. All three systems, we were hoping, at least recorded onto VHS tape, actually SVHS tape, slightly better quality, exactly what happened. You know, the laptops that would have recorded a much lower resolution Windows media file from the cameras, you know, it was just really, really important. And I thought, wow, this is hard because I want to go home. I miss my family. You know, Rebecca and the children missed me, and I had been gone for the better part of a week. So I talked to Rebecca, my wife, and after I dropped Mike off, and it was a hard conversation because, you know, she knew that I wanted to get back to Mississippi and try to find these missing boxes, how important they would be, but she also needed me home. And it's not just a matter of missing me, but I was needed, you know, had to play a role as the father of the kids and to help out at the house. And that was tough. It really was. And I got to the junction of I-10, where I-75 is, after Lake City, and I could either go right, which is east, and go home, or go left and go west back to Mississippi. And that's what I had to do. I felt like I needed at least to try for one day. So that's what I committed to. I was like, all right, I'll go back and I'm just going to look on Wednesday, the 31st, and then I will come home. And that was kind of the compromise. And that was it. I started west and I was by myself now. I was not streaming live. I don't remember why. Maybe I was just tired and didn't have the motivation at the time. I don't know. But I was not streaming live. Plus, I knew once I got into Alabama and beyond, I wouldn't be able to stream live. There's no infrastructure. It's all wiped out. You know, the Sprint network was almost entirely crippled. And I knew I had to get some supplies, you know, just for about a day. Some extra water, some more gas, things like that. And so I stopped at a gas station, one of the larger gas stations that I encountered. I'm sure like a TA or something along Interstate 10, who knows, maybe near Crestview or Niceville or somewhere, and got some waters, got some junk food, I'm sure, knowing me at the time, and filled up the gas tank on the Tahoe and had plenty of gas, 500-600 miles worth, no problem there, and off I went. It was getting late in the afternoon, sun was hanging low in the sky, it was a beautiful evening setting up. As I got through Alabama, eastern Alabama, you go through Loxley and eventually the Daphne, Alabama area, Fairhope, cross the bridge, Mobile Bay, sun's going down. You know, I kind of felt positive about everything. Had the whole vehicle to myself, listened to the radio, you know, which was just news, basically, about Katrina. And I thought, all right, I'm going to get into Mississippi. It's going to be weird. Certainly because of all they're going through there, and I'm going to find those boxes. I was just determined. I will find them. You know, they're not gone. They didn't disappear into an alternate universe. You know, they didn't go into lava and disintegrate. Yes, they could be at the bottom of the Gulf. I understood that, or buried in tremendous amounts of debris. So there was a little bit of denialism going on, but I thought, I'm going to find them. I'm a pretty positive guy in most cases, and this was one of them. So I pressed west, got through Mobile. The tunnel was open again. That was kind of nice. I didn't have to detour around Mobile again. And I got into Mississippi, and the sun was down, and you know it's like 8:30, 9 o'clock. And boy, it was so odd. Everything was dark. Pascagoula should be to my south. It was, but there was not a single light to be seen. Really, you know, maybe the occasional generator-powered light that you could see somewhere, but no city glow. And if you travel at night, you guys know what I'm talking about. You see the city glow, even a small city, a small town. Something's on, the gas station, the McDonald's, whatever. Nope, nothing. And just as dark as it could be, it was like driving into an abyss. And the farther west that I traveled, Moss Point, Pascagoula, Gaucher, you name it, Van Cleve, whatever those exits, you know, just darkness. And the occasional boat that I would pass that was still on the interstate because the storm surge was so high. Crippled vehicles. Lots of disabled vehicles. People who ran out of gas, or maybe the vehicle just broke down. Who knows what. And it was weird. It was like driving into a movie set. I say that a lot in these stories, but it's true. And I got to Gulfport at the interchange there. Highway 49 and I-10. Big checkpoint. Lots of emergency vehicles, yellow lights flashing, orange lights flashing. You say, what's the difference, yellow and orange? But the different work trucks, the kind of amber color, if you will, white lights on some of the vehicles, red lights on some, blue lights on others, even green lights. It was like a, like if you had seizures and epilepsy and you saw this, it would have not been good, believe me. It was like, wow, that's a lot of activity there. And it was a big checkpoint is what it was. And I was a little worried that they wouldn't let me in, but it took about 15 minutes for the traffic to get through it, and I got my turn, and I had the Tahoe, and I told them what I was doing there and why I needed to go back. Showed them the little badge that I had from, it was like a little ID card that Hancock County made for Mike and me on Sunday, the 28th. David Garcia, the fire chief, had arranged that with Hancock Emergency Operations Center, and they let me through. It was no question. I'm driving the Tahoe. It's got all the instrumentation on it, the Hurricane Intercept Research Team logo. I mean, I'm not there to loot, clearly. So they let me in, and that was not a problem. Went down off the interchange there and crossed the railroad tracks. There's two sets of tracks. There's one in Gulfport right there near the interstate, and I think it's like near Creosote Road or something. You cross those, and then you go south, and there should be a Shell station on your left, something like that. The Home Depot, the Tanger Outlets, or whatever it's called on the right, and the hotels, Best Western, Hampton Inn, the Wendy's, the Burger King, all that kind of stuff. All of it's dark. You know, the traffic lights are out. There's a few vehicles, some flashing lights here and there from utility trucks or something, but it's like, you know, otherwise dark and just completely alien. Very, very odd feeling, and I've never, ever gotten used to it all these years later, anytime we've ever seen it. You know, we think about the 2020 season, how busy that was, 2018, Michael aftermath. I mean, I don't get used to it, never. Pulled into the hotel parking lot, went under the sort of half-collapsed canopy there. I went inside, saw Rose, the manager, and I just cannot say enough about what a pillar of strength that lady was. She had held a room for me and said, yeah, it's clean and everything. You're good to go. It's on the first floor right around the courtyard over there. I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. Thank you so much. And she's like, yeah, good luck. You know, whatever's in those boxes could be very helpful. I was like, I know, you know, it's important. And went to the room, and you have the key card, and I guess the little RFID things that works off of. And yes, they had that back then. It's got to be battery powered, I would assume. And opened the door, went in, and closed the door, and was like, whoa, this is not good. It was so quiet, and like it was like everything stopped. It was like being in a sound booth or a cave or something, seriously. And it just gave me immediately this sense of dread and almost like a panic attack. Because, I mean, it was so quiet in that room and so dark. There's no AC running. There's no power. There's no hum of a refrigerator, a little mini fridge. Nothing. Nothing. And I could hear and feel my heart beating in my chest. It was so darn quiet. And I was like, yeah, this isn't going to work. And I was not ready to go to sleep yet. It's probably 11:30 at night by now, something like that. You know, not quite midnight yet. I did know that. And I was like, yep, this isn't going to work. Too many thoughts going on in my head. Too quiet. Nope. So I had left and went out and sat in the Tahoe and thought, okay, let me just kind of chill. And, you know, what was that all about? Like I said, I felt like I was going to have a panic attack. I couldn't call anybody. I couldn't call Paul in Nevada. He would have been 2 hours behind, probably still awake. And he knew that I was going back. You remember, Paul was a real good friend, good colleague, very integral in this whole story. I mean, he got me on Art Bell, for goodness sake, for the interview there with Art, the night of the 28th into the 29th. And I had talked to Paul on the way back and talked to Jesse, of course, Jesse Bass. And I couldn't call any of them. You know, there was no network. It just didn't exist. It was crippled. No texting. That was a bummer. And no email. I couldn't email anybody. You know, and the laptop, I could turn it on in the Tahoe and just kind of look at any of the video that we had digitized. And I just kind of felt like, all right, this stinks. You know, I don't know anybody here. I know Rose a little bit. I'm not going to go talk to her. That would just be weird. And I could hear people walking around and an occasional vehicle would pull in. And it just started dawning on me that, yikes, you know, this is bad. I'm like in a disaster zone. And I got to figure out what I'm going to do, you know, because I don't really have a plan. Can I even get to the waterfront tomorrow? Are they going to let me, you know? So I kind of gathered my thoughts, did a little video of myself in the car. And I got to find that, by the way. I don't have it readily available now. You have to understand that this was shot on mini DV, and I don't have a mini DV camera anymore. That camera stopped working a number of years ago. I still have all the tapes. So maybe one day we'll do like a lost episodes of Stories from the Hurricane Highway, even if it's a mini episode, and I'm going to find that tape. I still have the mini DV tapes, yes. And I should just send them all off to like Legacy Box or somebody and get them all digitized. And maybe I can just put them all online for you guys one day. That's an idea. That's a heck of a project. But seriously, I would like to let you hear that audio. It was kind of interesting. Just me talking to the camera. I felt like Survivor Man. You remember that show? He would sit out there and talk to the camera in the wilderness when he was alone. That's how I felt. And so I just kind of talked to the camera. Hey, here I am. It's weird. I can hear, you know, kind of crickets outside, maybe the generator here or there. Whatever. I was just kind of doing a video diary on camera because there was nobody else to talk to. So I gathered my thoughts and kind of got control of my emotions. And I was a little bit nervous, you know, didn't really know how things were going to end and what my chances really were. And not having anybody there with me, that started weighing on me as well. So I just took a deep breath. I was like, all right, let's go. And I just drove the Tahoe down towards the waterfront at 11 o'clock at night, whatever. And I figured there'd be a checkpoint down there. And I thought, well, let me just go introduce myself, find out who's in charge for Wednesday the 31st, and make sure I'm even going to be allowed to go down there. And that's exactly what I did. I drove down 49 through, you know, these dark intersections, very little traffic out there. The occasional police car would drive by, maybe a civilian vehicle of somebody that lives there or whatever. Mostly a few power trucks, that kind of thing, but not much traffic at all. And you would see these downed power lines just off in the edges of the way the Tahoe would light the roadway. You know, it's just always such a weird feeling and a weird scene, so different and so alien than what we're used to, for sure. And, you know, I had to go slow. You have to be very careful. There's no lights anywhere, and you could run into a transformer that's in the road, a piece of glass, or who knows what, sheet metal. Stuff had been bulldozed and moved since Mike and I were there, you know, basically a day before, on the 29th, late in the 29th. An entire day had gone by for things to be a little bit different. So I had to be very careful. And I didn't just roar down Highway 49 there in the Tahoe. That would have been foolish. So I made my way south, whatever it is, a couple miles. And sure enough, there was a checkpoint near the next set of railroad tracks. These are the railroad tracks that are close to Highway 90. And those tracks go all the way across Gulfport, you know, past Christiane, Long Beach, all that, all the way over to eventually going across the St. Louis Bay on a separate bridge and then through Bay St. Louis and Waveland. That's this set of railroad tracks. And that's important for later on, all right? Just remember that. So at this set of railroad tracks, which basically delineates the real blast zone, if you will. That's what I call it. As macabre as that sounds, that's a great description. South of the railroad tracks to Highway 90, everything is either completely destroyed or significantly damaged. And I don't mean like a couple windows blown out, a little roof damage here and there. That line, that railroad track area south, was truly the line of demarcation of utter destruction versus major to moderate to minor damage, depending on where you were. And most of it south of the tracks was because of the storm surge. So that's where the checkpoint was set up. Lots of generator-powered lights, I remember. A few National Guard Humvees, several soldiers, personnel, whatever you call them, right? They would be called soldiers, right? And law enforcement, Mississippi State Police, that kind of thing. And I got really lucky, I do remember this, that the Tahoe is the reputation that precedes me, if you will. As I approached all this bright light, you know, in this area, one of the soldiers came up and he saw the Tahoe and he was like, "Whoa, man, look at that. You know, you must have been chasing that hurricane or something." He had something clever to say. And I was like, "Yes, sir. Yeah, this is our work vehicle, kind of like a hurricane hunter on wheels. Yes, sir." And he was like, "That is awesome." And he looked inside and he could see the laptop running and the little wind tracker on the dashboard and the Davis console for all that. You know, he's like, I guess the guy was into the weather. And that really helped my situation because we immediately had a rapport established. And I told him what I was doing there, why I was there, and what my task was for Wednesday. I need to find these boxes. And I even asked him, you know, just on the sheer chance, right? You know, "Hey, by the way," and I pulled up a picture of them on the laptop. "Has anybody seen any of these? You know, I'm sure there's a snowball's chance in hell, right? But just in case." And "No, no, sir, nobody's seen anything like that." And he's like, "What is that, a pelican case?" I'm like, "Yes, yes, that's exactly right." And he was pretty interested in it, is the bottom line. So he's just there helping out, you know, the National Guard helping keep things secure. He got the attention of one of the local law enforcement officials. I don't remember who that was, but he came over. We talked for a minute. I got his business card. He got mine. And he was like, "Yep, you can come down tomorrow. Shouldn't be a problem. You got my card. If anybody gives you any trouble, you know, just tell them to call me or they can radio me." And that's what they would have done because calling was not going to happen because the whole network was ruined. But they had radios, presumably, right, that still worked. And so it was all set. And that was a real, like, shot in the arm for me. I thought, "Oh, all right, you know, I have a plan now. I am going to be able to find these boxes. I've got permission from somebody here in Gulfport, one of the officials. I'm going to be good. You know, I'm not going to have to worry about that aspect of this." So I drove back to the hotel with renewed enthusiasm, much more positive outlook on things. Went back to the room. I was thinking, you know, I would love to call Jesse or Paul or text them or something. I knew that Rebecca would be asleep back home with the young kids. So I was like, I got to tell somebody because this is exciting. I'm going to find those boxes. You know, I was so pumped. And I knew that I couldn't because I looked at my phone. It was a Sanyo bar phone. And, you know, there's no signal. The Sprint logo and everything on the little LCD screen and the little signal strength, there was just nothing. It was dead. No data, no signal. And I went out and stood in front of the room, you know, opened the door and stood in the courtyard just kind of listening to the crickets and the sound of the dolphins still in the pool. They would break the water surface. You can hear them. It's like almost like children playing in the pool. And I heard somebody, you talk about coincidence. What an amazing coincidence of things. I heard somebody up on the second floor saying to somebody else, yeah, I just got a message to my Uncle Bob or something. You got to do text message and you can't call him and you got to do it on that corner of the building. And I raced up there, went up the stairs, all this outside corridor, right? Went up the stairs and was like, hey, excuse me. You were saying you were able to send a text? They were like, yeah, I just sent a text to my uncle or something, or whatever they said. And I was like, wow. And they're like, yeah, you can do text. They kind of reiterated it to me how to do it. Oh, yeah, you know, you can do text, but you can't call. And I remember it's like it all came back to me. Duh. You know, the voice spectrum is not going to work right now, but the data spectrum might. And I remember talking to some of the Sprint engineers about that over the couple of years that I had been working with Sprint, that sometimes the digital side would be working as opposed to the voice side, especially because the voice side could get overwhelmed with lots and lots of people trying to use those switches and whatever. It just kind of all came back to me, like I said. I was like, oh, yes, of course. You know, text messaging has a much better chance. Simple text messaging, not sending pictures as attachments, you know, but just a simple one-liner, hey, I'm here, I'm good, whatever. Yes, that could work. And this person, I think it was a woman, said, you got to do it over on that corner near the woods. And I guess it was just an area that was high enough up, exposed enough, no buildings blocking it, that it was able to get enough of a signal. And I said, you know, who's your carrier? And they said, oh, we're with Sprint. I was like, oh, hallelujah. I thought, I know it's late at night now, you know, close to midnight or so central time, but I'm going to text Jesse. You know, I figured he was probably up watching all this news coverage. Jesse got really involved with it, even if he wasn't there in person. And I'm going to take a chance. You know, I'm going to text him. I'm going to text Paul. And I did. I texted them and I don't remember back then how you would know if a text went through. These days, like on an iPhone, you use the iMessage and it says delivered. You see the little progress bar, then it goes delivered. And then if they read it, you know, and you wait for them, it says read. And then you see the little dots go by when they're responding, right? No, we didn't have that back in 2005. You sent the message and you hope it went through. And within a couple of minutes, Jesse responded back when I told him, you know, I'm in Gulfport, I have a plan, I've got permission, I'm going to find those boxes. Dude, I'm excited, we're going to make history. He responded with like, you know, good, you know, it's like G-O-O-O-O-D, exclamation point. And he was like, bro, I'm real tired, I'm happy for you though. Good luck tomorrow, I'm getting ready to go to bed. New Orleans is a disaster, I don't know if you've heard. It's starting to fall apart there. Be careful, he said, watch your back. And I reiterated on a response message, I do have permission from Gulfport officials. I should be okay. As soon as I find anything, I will let you know. And I need you to let people on the website know. And he knew how to FTP in and update my web pages and stuff, should that happen. And we were all set. And that was it. I said, good night. He's like, good night, man. Love you. Stay safe down there. And I was like, almost shed a tear, you know. I was like, all right, I've got support. You know, I had talked to Rebecca earlier in the day. She knew the plan. I was going to get home eventually. My parents knew that I was good, you know. And I remember they were pretty apprehensive about me heading back into the danger zone, if you will. But everything was positive at this point. I had reason for hope. I had a plan. I had the you know, permission from the PD, whatever. You know what I mean? Like, it felt like fate was going to be on my side, that I was going to go find those boxes, at least one of them, maybe all three, and that I would find with those boxes what was the important part of all of this, and that is answers. Answers to the question, or questions, plural, really, of how did this happen, unlocking secrets as to the process, the timing. What can we learn from watching this video? I really felt like, and I've been a very, very strong advocate of this since day one of my entire career, that video is data. And we know that. They use video in all kinds of evidentiary proceedings in court cases for a variety of things. There are photogrammetry experts out there who analyze video who can tell you, like, car crashes, plane crashes, you know, criminal cases, whatever. Video is data. It is a visual data. And there's a lot that can be extracted from it. And I got to make that very clear. Always, always, always. It's not just what we see on television, the eye candy, if you will, the sensational, incredible, viral videos that we see, you know, whatever. We know all about that. But there's the other side of it. The science that can be extracted from the video, that's why I was excited. Because I thought, there's so much riding on this, because we can see what happened, how it happened, understand it, give the video to engineers, geologists, meteorologists, university types, who knows? Use it for PSAs in future hurricane training videos, you know, have a public tour of showing. I mean, I had all these wild ideas about how the video that I'm going to find, and it was all going to come down to those SVHS tapes that, I mean, I was literally putting, you know, the cart before the horse here, or counting my chickens before they hatched, that once I found even one of those boxes, it was going to change things forever. It really would. And I would have the support of the National Hurricane Center. It would change things with them, you know, because I would have found a way and proven that it worked to document the worst hurricane in United States history, and I was nowhere near it in terms of being in extreme danger. I was at my hotel room. You get it? It was so much, there was so much riding on this. Like, I was so happy. It was like getting ready to go to sleep, and the next day you're playing in the Super Bowl. That's how I felt. I really did. That is not hyperbole. You know, oh man, that's a little bit of a stretch, Mark. That's how I felt. That Wednesday, August 31st, would be my Super Bowl. And that I would show the world, after finding these boxes, something that they had never seen before that would truly change the course of how we understand hurricanes forever. Well, after all of the excitement of the 30th, of dropping Mike back at his car, saying goodbye to him and all the help he had given me, going back west on I-10, the checkpoints I had to get through, you know, all these hurdles that were seemingly going to be in my way, they weren't. You know, I was able to conquer those hurdles, if you will. It almost seemed like I was destined to find these boxes and succeed at this project, even if I found one of them, and that was it. The SVHS tape especially was going to be so critical and so important, and I just felt like everything was falling into place, kind of guiding me to that end. It was like my Super Bowl was coming up. I know that sounds pretty grandiose, but I felt like my Super Bowl is coming on August 31st, 2005, and it's going to happen in Gulfport, Mississippi. I'm going to find one, two, three of those boxes, and the video data from that is going to just be incredible. It'll be so helpful. I was so confident and so excited that I had put all that anxiety that I had right when I got to Gulfport a few hours earlier behind me. And so it's no surprise to tell you that when I hit the pillow to finally go to sleep and shut everything off, that I had a smile on my face. You know, I was content and I was full of confidence and full of, you know, enthusiasm that after a good night's sleep, with very little to worry about, I was safe. You know, I'm locked in this hotel room. Nobody's going to get me. We don't have riots and any problems or looters or anything wild happening. It's bad in Mississippi, yes, but I'm safe. I'm in a good place. I got people supporting me, and I felt really good about what was going to come next on August 31st, 2005. And with that, we will wrap up this episode. Kind of a little bit of a cliffhanger for you, but that'll do it for this episode of Stories from the Hurricane Highway. I am Mark Suddeth. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you again next week.